Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an historical perspective on the election appeal of Donald Trump and look back at right-wing populist and nativist movements like the Know Nothing movement and the presidential campaign of the segregationist George Wallace. American political historian Alan Lichtman, who teaches at American University, joins us. He has studied both the American right and the presidency and has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, and we will look into the large and growing constituency of America that supports Donald Trump and his policies. Then, with the Senate passage of the bipartisan Every Student Achieves Act, which closes the chapter on the controversial No Child Left Behind Act, championed by George W. Bush, we will speak with Diane Ravitch. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George W. Bush and is the author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, in which she explains how she came to make a radical break with the No Child Left Behind policies. We will discuss the relentless pressure from predatory business interests, homeschooling evangelicals, and billionaire dilettantes to privatize education, which Diane Ravitch writes about in her latest book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Then finally, we'll look into Time Magazine's choice of its 2015 Person of the Year, Angela Merkel, and speak with Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, who specializes in German politics. We will discuss the reasons for Angela Merkel's popularity at home and abroad, and the obvious contrast to her handling of the refugee crisis in Europe and the policy pronouncements of one of the other candidates on Time Magazine's shortlist, Donald Trump. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is an American political historian who teaches at American University. He has studied both the American right and the presidencies, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
And the Know Nothing Party, also known as the American Party, which was prominent in the United States in the early 1850s, its platform essentially, first of all, the majority of its constituents and voters were white American Protestants. But the main platform that it sort of espoused was that it strongly opposed immigrants and Catholics. So to my mind, all you have to do is switch the word Catholic with Muslims, and here you've got Donald Trump.
There is always a group to demonize. The identity of the group changes, but the demonization remains unchanged. Early in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, it was believed that Catholic immigrants from Ireland would ruin the country. Then it was the Germans who would destroy America, or the Chinese who would take over this country. Then, of course, later on, it was the Jews from Eastern Europe, and that led to sharply restrictive immigration laws in the 1920s. And then, of course, later on, it was the Hispanics who were going to destroy the culture and backbone of America. And now it's the Muslims. There is always someone to hate. It never changes. It's almost as old as the Republic. In fact, in the early Republic, it was the French Canadians who were going to destroy the country. There's always someone to go after. And, of course, with respect to Donald Trump's pronouncements, it is kind of unique. How do you keep out a religion? How do you know what religion someone professes? It's not like the country of origin or the city of origin. Religion is a purely voluntary, self-imposed factor. So unless you're going to do what the Nazis did, you know, have a biological police checking out the heritage of every single person who wants to come to this country, it is absurd to ban a religion. It makes absolutely no sense.
But in terms of the constituency that Donald Trump is appealing to, because as much as Donald Trump himself is being criticized now across the board and by a number of Republican leaders, not by too many of his competing candidates, and certainly by not by a lot of the right-wing talk show hosts, but nevertheless, it would seem to me that it's not just a question of criticizing. If you want to criticize Donald Trump, surely you have to criticize those that flock to his banner. And my question would be to you, as a historian, Alan Lichtman, is there a kind of permanent constituency that goes back to the know-nothing days in America? Has it always been this kind of nativist constituency?
Nativism is very old and very American. People don't understand that after the dissolution of the Whig Party in the early 1850s, it was the Know-Nothing Party, better known as the American Party, of course, at least that's their official name, that was competing with the newly formed Republican Party to become the second of the two parties in America. You had the Democratic Party, which continued to exist, and it was touch and go as to whether the American Party, based upon nativism, in fact, would become the second major party in the United States. And, of course, we know, fast-forwarding much later into 1968, that independent candidate George Wallace, who took a stand on segregation forever in the South, received about 13% of the vote in the presidential election of 1968, and at one point was polling at about 25%. So there is, and has been for many, many years, going back to the roots of the Republic, a constituency for nativism. Let's not forget one of the big controversies, even going back to 1800, were the alien and sedition laws that imposed and new restrictions upon immigrants to the United States. And that was one of the hot-button issues in the presidential election, not of 2016, but of 1800.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way of predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, and his latest book is FDR and the Jews. So in terms of the Know-Nothing movement, they could have morphed into the Republican Party back for the fact that they wouldn't take a stand on slavery. So their political DNA is pretty prominent. And in terms of George Wallace, it seems like, but for the fact that he picked Curtis LeMay as his running mate, he might have done a lot better, right? I
mean, he might have got done better, but I think the biggest problem for Wallace, as for any other third-party candidate, is what I call the wasted vote syndrome. We love you, George, but we know you can't win, so we'll vote for someone else. That's why third-party candidates usually poll at about twice what they actually get in the election. But he was polling at 25%, showing there's a pretty large constituency. Let's not forget about the restrictive immigration laws of the 1920s, which were deeply anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, based upon the phony belief that these immigrants were biologically inferior and were affecting the body of Americans.
Well, in George Wallace's case, though, first of all, he wasn't wealthy like Trump, but he did get small donations, basically somewhat along the lines of what Bernie Sanders is getting. The only large donations he got were for the billionaire Texas oil man Bunker Hunt, and from all people, John Wayne, who inscribed on one of his checks to George Wallace, "Sock it to them, George." So, and Wallace's tirades were against hippies, the Supreme Court, and big government, but his appeal was to the white working man.
Absolutely. You know, he was somewhat left-wing, and maybe a bit like Trump. You know, Trump is not quite the same on economic policy as he is on social policy. Same thing with Wallace. He was, you know, to the far right on social policy, but not necessarily on economic policy.
But in terms of unleashing these nativist forces and this Islamophobia, that, and of course the anti-Latino statements that sort of launched Trump's campaign, Do you think there's a possibility, just in terms of analogies, of it all backfiring in some ugly incident during this campaign? For example, at an October rally at the Madison Square Garden in 1988 for George Wallace, police had to rescue several black protesters who were surrounded by George Wallace supporters chanting, kill him, kill him, kill him. All of this, of course, on television. So is it possible that when you unleash these nativist and bigoted feelings stirring, bubbling beneath the surface, that you may end up with ugliness on camera?
That is always a risk. Whenever you stir hatred, you can't control hatred, and that's one of the biggest problems. And indeed, there is a real problem of blowback, overreaction, an incident that makes all of this go bad. Let's not forget, too, that while this attitude that Trump is portraying here does play to a segment of the Republican Party, it doesn't play nearly as well with the general electorate. And when you've had candidates of one extreme or the other, whether the left or the right, who don't move towards the center in a general election, they paid the price at the polls.
So given your accurate predictions of all presidential elections since 1984, Alan Lichtman, I guess you have to admit this one so far has been weaving and dodging all over the place. It's been a little unusual, to say the least. Still early days yet. But do you share the common prediction that Trump is going to flame out, even though so far every time he's outtopped himself with outrageousness, all that happens is he goes up in the poll?
I said 4 months ago on television, you know, when he was just getting rolling, that all the pundits were wrong, that Trump is not a Herman Cain or a Michelle Bachmann. He is not going to fade. I did not predict he was going to win the nomination, but I said if I had to bet on any one person out of this big field winning the nomination, I'd bet on Donald Trump. And nothing has changed my mind. The pundits are always wrong. Of course, nobody remembers anything they say, so it really doesn't matter. I got to run.
Well, Alan, I thank you very much for joining us. Just in the closing, who do you think will pick up the pieces if he does implode?
Well, you know, there are two candidates really only, and that's Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, I think, next in line if he does implode. But don't count on it.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Alan Lichtman.
Take care. Good night.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is an American political historian who teaches at American University. He has studied both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, and his latest book is FDR and the Jews. And we were talking then about the extraordinary historical analogies, if you will, between the Know Nothing movement, later known as the American Party, that was prominent in American politics in the early 1950s, and their anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic biases, and also the populist right-wing segregationist from Alabama, George Wallace, who ran for the presidency in 1988 and did quite well, and he ran again in 72, and was quite a threat then to President Nixon, and was shot by Arthur Bremer, a peculiar character who became in many ways the inspiration for Martin Scorsese's film Taxi Driver. So these are the forces that are out there amongst, I was going to say the great unwashed, but that sounds elitist, but they're certainly out there in our American political landscape, and it is certainly dangerous and irresponsible to stir them up and to exploit them. But that seems to be pretty much what is happening at the moment, and we simply don't know when you reach, in other words, how deep this toxic well is. It continues to surprise people that Trump is still in the race and more people support him. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the Senate passage of the bipartisan Every Student Achieves Act that closes the chapter on the controversial No Child Left Behind Act, championed by George W. Bush.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
Teach your children well. Their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Ravitch. She's a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Bill Clinton and served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice testing standards and No Child Left Behind and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explained how she came to make a radical break with those policies. Her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you very much.
And the Senate voted on Wednesday to pass an overhaul of the No Child Left Behind law, and the House of Representatives, of course, passed a similar bill last week. The President's expected to sign it. The Senate measure passed 85-12, and the bill will apparently will be signed on Thursday. So there seems to be a fairly strong national consensus there, at least reflected in the House and Senate votes, that No Child Left Behind was a mistake. So as one of its architects, what do you think went wrong?
Well, actually, I have to say, in my own defense, I was not one of its architects, but I've been a critic of it for a long time. I had nothing to do with the writing of it. It was a disastrous bill, and it should have been reauthorized in 2007, but everyone got hung up on what to do next. And it took, I think, the leadership of Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, the senator from the state of Washington, to forge a bipartisan consensus. And that consisted of doing a kind of clever turn. That is, that they basically gutted the role of the federal government, which is something that Republicans always wanted and Democrats didn't. But in this case, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, had alienated so many people with his heavy hand that there was an agreement that the federal role should be scaled back. The law passes to the states the responsibility to fulfill almost everything that was in No Child Left Behind. The testing is still there. The annual testing is there. The states are supposed to have standards, which sound as though they might actually be the Common Core standards. They call them challenging standards, and they use the word college and career ready, which is a synonym for the Common Core. And while the federal role is reduced considerably, states still have to get approval from the federal government. So there are some people who think that this act, which is called the Every Student Succeeds Act, is somewhat different from No Child Left Behind, but it still contains the twisted soul of No Child Left Behind and the race to the top, both of which were failed programs because they operated by punishing people. And education doesn't get better by punishing people.
Well, the punishment, I guess, came in the form of tests, right? It was explain the dark soul, if you will, of this misstep.
The dark soul of No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top was that if they could only threaten teachers enough and threaten schools with closing them, they would threaten teachers and principals that you'll lose your job if your scores don't go up, and they threatened schools to close them if their scores didn't go up, and In fact, No Child Left Behind said it was a mandate in No Child Left Behind that every student in every school would be proficient by the year 2014, or the school would suffer drastic punishments, including having the school closed. Many schools were closed because they were not moving towards that target. And when Arne Duncan came into office, he added race to the top, which bought into the entire package of No Child Left Behind and made it even more punitive, because he said that the schools and the states had to agree to judge their teachers by test scores. That has turned out not to work anywhere. So that's called value-added assessment. If the teacher can't produce higher test scores, then it's his or her fault, and they have to be fired. So both of these, the law, No Child Left Behind, and the program, Race to the Top, were filled with ways to punish teachers, fire principals, close schools, and they created tremendous revulsion. In New York State, we had an opt-out movement this spring in which one out of every five students who were supposed to take the test didn't take it. Their parents obviously didn't want them to take it. They thought there was way too much emphasis on testing. So I think the Congress heard this to some extent, but they've really shifted the burden to the states. And the only virtue, first of all, the main virtue is No Child Left Behind is gone. But then you have it succeed. The successor bill is called Every Student Succeeds. Well, I don't know what the difference is between No Child Left Behind and Every Student Succeeds. The original name of the Federal Education Act was the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And that was a good descriptor. Putting a prediction into the name of a law is really, I think, a very bad idea, because I can tell you that when this law expires in 2020, every child will not have succeeded, and many children will still be left behind.
And again, I'm speaking with Diane Ravitch, who's a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Bill Clinton and served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Through extensive speaking and writing, she has established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice testing standards, No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies. And her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. So in terms of just trying to get a handle on what happened here with No Child Left Behind and what the intentions were compared to the results, what kind of metric can you really have in education to show progress? It sounds like there was this sort of mercantile, corporate kind of idea of progress, you know, like the annual report or quarterly reports, you know. Whereas, you know, how do you measure intellectual curiosity and engendering it? How do you measure real progress in terms of children's aptitude to think and express, as opposed to learn by rote? And frankly, one thing that I've always found extraordinary since I wasn't born in this country and was educated abroad is how much American education is kind of like a driver's license test where you have a multiple choice. And to me, that's it's completely bogus. It makes it so easy. You know, you can figure out the answers by just looking at all the choices as opposed to knowing anything. And
right.
That always struck me as being a way to set up a system that appears to be working, but it's not providing, it may be providing education, but it's certainly not providing knowledge.
Well, I think what you've done, Ian, is to hit on the problem of No Child Left Behind and also Race to the Top and the whole mindset. And it's still embedded in this new act called Every Student Succeeds Act. And that is that you can test all children, every child every year, and you can use these numbers to say whether it's a good school or a bad school. And the problems are multiple. First, you identified one of them, which is that multiple choice tests are really dreadful tests. They're not a good way to say whether teachers are doing a good job. Teachers are forced to teach to these multiple choice tests if they want to keep their job, because if the scores don't go up, they may be fired. And the tests just aren't that good. If you want to know what's the most important thing in education, creativity, ingenuity, using your mind to think of good questions, not just finding the right answer or picking the right bubble, And we don't have good ways of measuring that. I think that we should be trusting our educators, first of all, to be very well educated, and that should be something the state can insist on, that no one should teach based on, I want to be a teacher and I've studied it for a few weeks. That's ridiculous. But this bill will allow states to set those standards. And in many states, the standards will be very low. So I think that the most important way to judge the quality of work of a school is actually to have people, educators, look at the kind of student work that's coming out of that school, look at the attendance rates. What the standardized tests are very good at doing is telling you where the poor kids are, because standardized tests are actually a measure of family income. And there's a chart that's published every year by the SAT, the College Admissions Test, and it shows the scores along with family income, and it is uncanny how closely correlated the test scores are to who's wealthy and who's poor. So we could save we could save billions of dollars on testing and test prep if we just ask about the family income, and then we would have a good idea of what the test scores are. So we have a false metric, and we have a federal law that for 15 years, or almost 15 years, has been tied to this false metric. And now the responsibility for this will be shifted to the states, because the bill still requires that every state will test every child every year. This is something that is not done in most other nations, and it's not done in any high-performing nation.
So when things get devolved to the states, and as you mentioned earlier, this is something the Republicans are happy about and to some extent the Democrats rolled on, that's very understandable. But one of the things that I find extraordinary, and I remember hearing a piece about it yesterday, I think, on NPR, was how in North Carolina, school teachers aren't paid a living wage, which gives you an idea of the attitude that the state has towards education. And so is this the danger of devolving to the states, that you go back to this kind of these feudal standards that they have in a lot of the southern states?
Well, I think that the risk is that there are states like North Carolina, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Michigan, Ohio. I mean, you could just go down the laundry list of red states and say that in many of these states, the goal of the policymakers, the legislature and the governor, is to get rid of public education. In Louisiana, for example, Bobby Jindal got through laws there that allow not only privately managed charters, and by the way, California has more privately managed charters than any other state, but also to have vouchers, and most of the vouchers were being used in these backwoods rural schools where kids were learning creationism. Well, creationists, science, whatever that is, doesn't prepare you for the 21st century. But there are other states where the voucher movement is in full swing, Nevada being one of them, Wisconsin another. And so you have these red states where the goal is get rid of public education and let parents choose to go wherever they want to go, including underwriting homeschooling. So how that's supposed to improve our country is something I find very hard to understand. And that's a risk. North Carolina, since 2010, has been under the control of the Tea Party. And they have a Tea Party governor and Tea Party legislature. And they have added bonuses for brand-new teachers, so that brand-new teachers, which will be Teach for America, will be making more than experienced teachers. And it just doesn't make any sense at all, other than to discourage teachers. And a lot of teachers in North Carolina are looking to move to other states, because even South Carolina pays more than North Carolina. And North Carolina used to be the most progressive state in the nation. Not in the nation, in the South. It used to be a very progressive state in the South, and it is no longer.
So what is driving that? Is there a kind of attitude amongst the business class? I mean, you'd think that the business people in this country would want educated workers, but then I've heard reports, I think one of the big hedge fund people in New York apparently said, why should we spend money on education in the United States when I can get really smart people from India? I don't know whether that's a factor. I think the religious fundamentalism is definitely a factor with creationism, and we know how strong those lobbies are in the Bible Belt. So give me a sense of this anti-intellectual brew that's loose in the land.
Well, you know, a lot of people have gotten into the privatization movement for a lot of different reasons. There's no single motive. There is a profit motive. There are entrepreneurs who are making money from charter schools, from leasing space and rent, buying the space and then leasing it back to themselves. and there are we now have publicly funded for-profit charter schools, which to me is crazy. But then I feel the same way about for-profit higher education. I don't think that a penny of public money should go to for-profit colleges, universities, or charter schools. But we have the greed motive is one. Then there are people who think that the government can't do anything right, and so homeschooling is better than public schools. And there's also been this phony narrative about our schools are failing, which is not true. And in my book, Reign of Error, I demonstrated using government data that actually, if you look at the test scores based on the federal test, which have no stakes attached to them and are based on scientific samples, test scores today are the highest point they've ever been. But they were rising steadily since the 1970s, and they just stopped in 2015, which is the result of all of this high-stakes testing, I think, because kids are not learning. They're just learning to take tests. And if they didn't study for the NAEP test, the National Assessment Test, that's not the test that means anything to them. So actually, graduation rates are the highest they've ever been. Test scores are the highest they've ever been. The dropout rate's the lowest it's ever been. And yet we have this group whom I call the corporate reformers, Bill Gates, Eli Broad of Los Angeles, the Walton family, the most far-right anti-union foundation in the country, all are supporting charters. The Walton Foundation is supporting vouchers. And then you have a very far-right group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which writes model legislation for how to produce charter legislation and voucher legislation, how to get rid of professional teachers and replace them with temps. There is a movement, and this is a very well-funded movement. The hedge fund managers have gotten behind charters because they believe in the free market. So you have all different kinds of motives, and some of them well-meaning, some of them ignorant, and some of them ill-intended. But the bottom line is it is a privatization movement, and they use testing to say that our schools are failing because they set an impossible bar, as they have with the Common Core testing. I mean, most of the kids in California fail the PARC test, but the PARC test is designed to fail most children. And that will not stop. That will continue until parents say, we're not going to allow our children to take this test anymore. This is ridiculous. To give a child a test that they can't possibly pass because it's set 2 years above them, or the passing mark is set beyond anything they can reach, parents should complain and they should opt out.
Well, I wasn't aware that federal money was now going to charter schools, just like it has been going to for-profit colleges, which it's approaching $40 billion a year, at least 30-something mm-hmm. billion going to for-profit colleges. And I've done a lot of investigation into that, and it is one of the most disgraceful rackets in the federal government, and it has bipartisan appeal, because they essentially recycle federal money, which then goes to the lobbyists who then fly our legislators around in private jets and get them to vote more money for these people who, some of them are totally fraudulent. They just hang up a shingle and get a bunch of kids, either mostly minority kids, get vets on the GI right. Bill, get them into these phony colleges, which they spend a lot of money, all of which is taxpayer money, on promotion, advertising. You see it every freeway exit now as a new college popped up out of nowhere.
Right.
And they advertise on TV. Again, it's your tax dollars that they're advertising with. And they give these kids worthless diplomas and saddle them with a lifetime of debt. To me, that goes beyond fraudulence. That's just cruel and unusual punishment. And I find it extraordinary that Arne Duncan, in this cheery way, has allowed this thing to metastasize. So to me, that's the biggest scandal of all. And the idea that maybe it's growing into, you know, K through 12, that's even worse.
Well, first of all, the for-profit colleges and universities are indeed a scandal, and they should have been cracked down on and closed long ago. I remember Senator Tom Harkin did a report on the for-profits and said they were a great fraud and that they should be closed down. And the industry hired the best lobbyists in both parties. Some of the most distinguished Democrats and Republicans who had left Congress became lobbyists for the online higher education industry, and I agree with everything you said about them. The degrees are worthless. I've been told by students that their degrees won't even be recognized by some employers because they know that they're either because they're online or they're for profit. But in either case, it's not a real education, and the kids are defrauded, and the taxpayers are stuck with a huge bill, and of course, the kids have enormous debt. We just recently saw the collapse of Corinthian colleges, or what, in which was a whole bunch of campuses, and it was one of the largest chains. And despite the fact that they had been paying enormous salaries to the executives, it collapsed because it was just a great fraudulent thing. But you see, Arne Duncan picked somebody from the for-profit sector to be his deputy secretary of education, Ted Mitchell, who at one time was the dean of Occidental College, and then became part of this whole corporate reform movement where for-profit became a positive thing. And he most recently had been CEO of the New Schools Venture Fund, which is based in California. And the New Schools Venture Fund encourages entrepreneurialism and for-profit enterprises in education. And we now have in this country a number of for-profit charter chains that operate all over the country. There are some states that don't allow them. But even in states that don't allow them, they can be the board of a charter school can actually contract out all of their responsibilities to a for-profit organization. So either way, people are getting money that taxpayers thought was going to go to reduce class size or to increase teachers' salaries. It's really a great scandal, and I don't know if I'm hopeful or not hopeful that a new administration might come in and clean this mess up. But the problem is, it's money in politics. And when people start making money and profit from an activity, they hire lobbyists, and they don't get regulated. That's the whole goal of having a lobbyist, is to avoid regulation and accountability, and that's what's happened with the charter sector. I mean, you have Eli Broad proposing to take over half the public school students in the city of Los Angeles with charter schools, and they will not be public schools. They will not be regulated. They will not be accountable. They will not be transparent. They probably won't be for profit, but nobody will know what's going on inside them because they're not public schools.
Well, Diane Ravitch, you've given us a lot to think about. I appreciate your work in drawing attention to these scandals, which I've done my best to cover over the years, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Ian. I hope you'll encourage your viewers to look at my blog, DianeRavitch.net, where I have been keeping up to date with all of the changes in federal law.
Well, thank you, and we'll do that. Diane Ravitch, DianeRavitch.net. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Ravitch, who's a professor in New York University Steinhardt School of Education and one of America's best-known education experts. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Bill Clinton and served as Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. Through extensive speaking and writing, she established a reputation as a conservative champion of school choice, testing standards, and No Child Left Behind, and other programs claiming to make schools more efficient and effective. In her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch explains how she came to make a radical break with those policies, and her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Time Magazine's choice of its 2015 Person of the Year, Angela Merkel. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Pleasure to be with you again, Ian.
And Angela Merkel, German Chancellor, has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Apparently, in terms of the shortlist, she beat out seven contenders, the Black Lives Matter activists, the Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the transgender celebrity Caitlyn Jenner, the Uber CEO Travis Kalanick, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani, and the reality TV star-turned-Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. So, not exactly pleasant company.
Quite an interesting group, yes. Well, it's nice to see it going to Angela Merkel as opposed to some of the others on that list.
So what do you think? I mean, first of all, the picture, the portrait, the painting they have of Angela Merkel on Time magazine's cover is, shall we say, less than flattering. But what do you think is her appeal, both in Germany and apparently in the United States?
Well, I mean, I think Angela Merkel stands for something that a lot of people in a lot of countries is looking for. And that is somebody who sort of manages to walk the line between a kind of high-minded idealism and a very pragmatic approach to politics, which is cognizant and aware of the limits that anyone in political offices has. And I think there's no issue which has illustrated this better than her efforts to deal with this enormous migration crisis, this refugee crisis that Europe and Germany in particular is confronted with. I mean, this is we're watching really a historically almost unprecedented. I mean, you'd have to go back to World War II to see this kind of large humanitarian crisis being faced by the continent, with literally millions of people fleeing the Middle East and coming into Europe. And this has provoked enormous degree of consternation. I mean, Germany alone, by the way, is now estimated they may have as many as 1.5 million people coming into Germany. And that's a country that's about a quarter of the size of the United States in terms of population. Will they be able to integrate these people? How will they be able to assimilate or integrate them economically, politically, culturally into the German system? What kind of security threats might be associated with the movement of that kind of people? So, you know, in the midst of all of this fear, which is feeding xenophobic reactions in Germany and in elsewhere, Merkel is taking a principled stand that Germany has to live up to its obligations. We do not want to have a situation where we are turning millions of people back to their potential death. At the same time, however, we have to recognize that this is a challenge and that there has to be common sense measures implemented to try to control this movement. And I think this is an enormous challenge for any political leader, but I think Angela Merkel is getting it right in as far as it is possible to get it right. I think that that's a message that I'm glad, you know, that, to the extent that Time magazine naming her as a person of the year, this is a message that, you know, deserves to be sent out and thought about carefully.
Well, clearly, in contrast, Germany's handling of the refugee crisis compared, say, to Hungary is night and day almost. But it also, I think, it's hardly even a subtext here, surely, that given that Donald Trump apparently was in the final amongst the finalists, and he clearly is represents the opposite of Merkel's pragmatism and compassion. He apparently said he wasn't surprised that Time magazine hadn't picked him, despite being the big favorite. Of course, you know, I'm huge, it's huge, etc. Typical bombast. But this is the quote: "They picked the person who is ruining Germany." And of course, clearly he's referring to in contrast to how she's accepting refugees from Syria, to his proposal to ban Muslims from entering the United States, even if it's supposedly on a temporary basis.
Well, I mean, look, without getting into too much of a discussion of Donald Trump and his particular views of the world, I think the obvious answer to them, I mean, at least two answers. First of all, many centrist people in Germany. I mean, of course, there are many people in Germany who share Donald Trump's concerns. In Germany, in France, I mean, we're seeing in Holland, I mean, we're seeing right now the rise of political parties, many of whom would be closer to Donald Trump than to Angela Merkel in their political views. Just this weekend, the Front National, under the leadership of Marine Le Pen, emerged as the dominant party in six of France's regions. So, you know, this is not something that's unknown. Germany as well, we have anti-immigrant marches. There's an organization known as Patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the Occident, of the West, and they're holding demonstrations in Germany. So, you know, this is not an unknown point of view. There are at least three points which I think Merkel and her supporters would raise, which cast doubt upon the kinds of solutions that Pegida or Donald Trump or the Front National would raise. First of all, there's a body of international law. Germans in particular would emphasize international law. Germany, as well as the United States, as well as France, Britain, and a host of other advanced industrial democracies, are signatories to the UN Convention, the Geneva Convention, on the protection of refugees. This was a treaty which was passed in 1951 in response to the tremendous humanitarian failings of the Nazi era and of the communist period. I mean, in the 1930s and 40s, millions of people were trying to flee Nazi oppression and communist tyranny, and they were being turned back. And in many cases, those people paid for that decision with their lives. I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people died as a result of that. We did not, including the United States after World War II, want to replicate that kind of enormous moral failing. Beyond the moralistic question, of course, there's the economic question. And German political representatives of German business and industry point out that Germany, like many other European countries and the United States, needs more people. There's a tremendous demographic shift. People are having fewer children. At the same time, we are having aging societies. Average population age is rising in Germany. They need more workers. And many of the people who are coming from the Middle East, especially from Syria, are now well-educated, middle-class people who have an enormous thirst and desire to build new lives. So this could be an economic boon if handled correctly. And then the third point is, if you're going to fight terrorism, you can't do this very effectively if you don't have the cooperation of the community of people from who the terrorists are trying to recruit, that is the Islamic world. What kind of message does, you know, turning away immigrants on the basis of their religion, what kind of message does that send to the literally millions of Turks, Moroccans, Algerians, Pakistanis who are living and who are already in many cases citizens in Europe? I mean, some of them are turning to terrorism, but the way to deal with that is to reach out to the communities. Most of the Turks, most Algerians, most Moroccans, most Pakistanis and Bangladeshis living in Europe, they want to lead. They want to have their piece of what we would call the American dream. Let's call it the European dream. They are willing to cooperate with the forces of law and order against radicalization. But you have to reach out to them, not marginalize them. And likewise, if we're going to fight terrorism or if we're going to try to get control of the refugee issue, we need the cooperation of Muslim countries. And that includes countries like Jordan, Lebanon, and yes, even though we differ with them, Saudi Arabia on many, many issues, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And again, an anti-Islamic immigration policy would only undermine our efforts. So this is in many ways a sort of unreflective anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, anti-Islamic message is frankly counterproductive.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berger, who's professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, comparative government, and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Now, in explaining why Time chose Angela Merkel as the person of the year, the editor-at-large of Time said, described her as the de facto leader of the European Union. Now, frankly, isn't that the interesting story, that Germany is really the emerging power, and the, you know, Britain is in eclipse and becoming rapidly irrelevant. But Germany seems reluctant to assume that role, and by extension, Merkel does it herself. She, you know, she doesn't. If anything, she's the opposite of bombastic.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the same, I mean, the Germany would like, I mean, there were polls which have been taken at different points in time asking back in the 90s already, after the end of the Cold War and when Germany had reunified, East and West Germany became a single country again, there were polls saying, what kind of country would you like to be? Would you like to be like the United States, for example, or like Great Britain or France? And the number one answer for Germans was Switzerland. They want to be a prosperous country which has a high standard of living and which focuses mostly on trying to improve the quality of life internally. And I think most Germans would agree with that. They don't have any particularly large vision of their playing, you know, a great role on the global stage, unlike the United States, unlike Britain or France, for that matter, or, you know, obviously People's Republic of China or Russia. In many ways, the Germans had such visions of grandeur beaten out of them through two world wars. And Angela Merkel, in some ways, sort of reflects some of that kind of spirit, sort of wanting to focus on practical issues and pragmatic issues without any kind of blowing of trumpets and fanfare. And so I do think that that's the German inclination. At the same time, however, Germany is both demographically the largest of the countries inside Western Europe. It's about 82 million people compared to about 65 for Britain or France. It is economically the strongest country in the region. And economics plays a central role in the politics of the European Union, and especially in the context of the recent euro crisis, Germany naturally rose right to the top. I mean, Germany, during the recent euro crisis, called the shots. There's also a kind of factor that both, especially France right now, has a relatively weak leadership. François Hollande's ratings are extremely weak. And David Cameron himself, while perhaps not quite as hapless as poor François Hollande, Prime Minister Cameron is faced with a lot of very difficult issues, Scotland and the question about whether Britain's going to stay in the European Union. So almost because her possible competitors are looking rather poor at the moment, Angela Merkel rises straight to the top.
Well, let's talk about the person, Angela Merkel. She's affectionately known in Germany as Mutti, which means mummy.
Right.
And she's very modest in her personal style. She and her second husband, who's a quantum chemist and a professor, live in the same apartment building. They, you know, go to soccer matches. She herself, of course, is a trained physicist who had quite a successful career in East Germany, where she was raised. And then after the wall fell, she was elected to the German Bundestag, the parliament, and within a year had her first cabinet post. And then she became the country's first female chancellor in 2005.
Right.
And 8 years later, as we speak, and now she's in her third term as Germany's chancellor. So by any measure, that's a pretty impressive political career. And yet, the thing that I find extraordinary about her is that you mentioned pragmatism. I mean, she's presiding over a left-right coalition that, at a time of crisis, with the unprecedented influx of refugees, the terrorist threat in Europe, etc., she's managing to calmly navigate. Now, if you compared what Merkel's handled in terms of bipartisanship compared to our broken government here in the United States, where you can't get the Republicans to agree on anything. I mean, the difference is just so stark in terms of, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Obama wouldn't like to be like Merkel, but he's simply in the wrong country. You know,
Well, there's a lot to that, yes. Well, I mean, again, Germany, because of its terrible experience, I mean, Germany went through not one, not two, but arguably three or even four catastrophes in the 20th century. I mean, it went through the First World War. It went through a disastrous economic collapse where inflation rates reached literally millions of percent a year. Then it went through the second, a Nazi dictatorship, collapse of democracy, and the Second World War. And then it was on the front line of the Cold War. And finally, it went through a very difficult process of reunification between East and West. So, you know, Germans have had their fill of historical events. And the German political system as such is built for consensus. It is political parties in Germany have various kinds of structural incentives which are built into the way in which German institutions function, which force them to work together on everything from creating governments in the local level, at the state level, picking Supreme Court justices. The German High Court is similar in many ways to our Supreme Court. And the Germans themselves want that. They expect it. One of the slogans already back in the 1950s was no more experiments, keine Experimente. We want, results. And I think the German political system, both institutionally and the German political culture, favors people like Angela Merkel, people who are willing to sort of put their personal ambitions or keep their personal ambitions in check and focus on the day-to-day business of making policy. In that many ways, Merkel is both the product and a beneficiary of that kind of approach to politics. I wish in some ways that we could have it in the United States, but I also have to say, we had a point in time not so long ago, if you went back 20, 30 years, the complaint about American politics was that we didn't have enough alternatives, that the Republicans and the Democrats were basically interchangeable with a few different issues. And we've worked our political system so we would have genuine alternatives. Well, we got it. Be careful what you wish for. And one byproduct of that, which I think was an unintended consequence in the United States, is the deep kind of partisan division that you're talking about. In any case, Germany is a beneficiary of this. Merkel is lucky in some ways. There are outlying parties, both on the left and on the right. There's a party called the Left Party, the Linken, who would have some sort of anti-system views. There's also a new right-wing party, which is establishing itself, possibly the Alternative for Germany party. But they're sort of isolated. And right now, there's a real conscious effort on the part of the left and center and the right of center parties to work together to prevent a upsetting of the apple cart. And again, Merkel has managed that very effectively as a political leader. Now, you mentioned her personal biography. One of the things which is interesting about Merkel and which makes her admirable is she's really very much an outsider. She is, as you pointed out, the first female chancellor in German history. She is unmarried. The CDU, the party, the Christian Democratic Union, which she represents, is socially quite conservative. The fact that she was divorced and then remarried without children was held against her. The CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, used to be more oriented towards Catholics. Now it's 50-50, but again, Merkel was an outsider as a Protestant and the daughter of a Protestant pastor. And she was raised in East Germany, which again raised all kinds of question marks. And when Merkel came into office in 2005, I think you said, she was really facing a lot of opposition, quiet but potentially fatal opposition to her within the party. But she systematically has outlasted through a combination of competence and political cunning. She's managed to see those challenges off. And as you said, she's now in the third term, and all the polls indicate that despite questions about certain parts of her politics, her policies that are expressed, including on the refugee issue, if she stands for election again, she could be could have a fourth term as chancellor, which is a pretty darn impressive accomplishment.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, comparative government, and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.